So we'll turn it over to Brother Stephen for his talk entitled The Bible and the Environment. Thanks.
Believe it or not, that is color. The word environment, it looks green on my screen on my laptop, so we'll see what the other color images look like. But it looks black and white to me. Well, good evening, brothers and sisters and young people. I'm going to do two things this evening. A little object lesson first. That's why there is a blackboard at the front. And then our main theme, which is what you see here, the Bible and the environment. And when I turn to that, I have some handouts, which I'll ask Matt to pass around. The first thing I need to ask is, are there brothers and sisters listening in the seniors housing complex? Okay, so I'm gonna cut out for a while because I'm going to walk down to the front. Is that, oh, okay.
Check.
Sounds like it's working. Okay. So what are we going to do first? Well, first of all, I'm going to move this blackboard a little bit because some of you over there on the right wing of the ecclesial hall won't be able to see this very well. Can everyone see the board? Yeah? Okay. Last year, when I was teaching one of my courses in Halifax, I heard an interesting news clip on. I saw it on the internet, and it was an interview with Richard Dawkins, the famous / infamous atheist, and an Anglican clergyman named Giles Fraser. And what Dawkins had done is he had done a survey of people in Great Britain who had signed the census form or had checked the box Christian on the census form, whenever the last census was. So he surveyed some of these people and he asked them, I think one or two questions, but one of them was, what is the first book in the New Testament? And a surprising number, I can't remember what the percentage was, but a very high number of people who said they were Christians couldn't say what the first book in the New Testament was. So what happened next is, during this interview, the Anglican clergyman said, well, you can't tell someone who says they're a Christian that they're not a Christian just because they don't know the first book in the New Testament, which, you know, for most of us is a very basic fact. So the Anglican clergyman asked Richard Dawkins if he could give the full title of The Origin of Species. And Dawkins rather foolishly said, yes, I could. And so then the Anglican clergyman said, go on then. And he didn't. He wasn't able to do it. And so the Anglican clergyman said, you're the high pope of Darwinism, and you don't even know the title of Darwin's Origin of Species. So first lesson is if you're on live radio, don't claim to do something that you really can't do. Does anyone know the full title of Darwin's Origin? No particular reason why you should. Okay. I asked my students, I passed around a sheet of paper and I said, write down the full title of Darwin's Origin of Species and the first book in the New Testament. 25 students, 6 students got the question about the New Testament correct. 2 or 3 wrote Genesis down, which, you know, I mean, you could see that they were thinking, right? Because it is the first book of the Bible. I had 1 Exodus and I had 1 Ezekiel. So I think what people were doing is they knew that there was a book in the Bible named, you know, called Exodus, so they just wrote that down. So, I mean, there's some knowledge there, but it's a pretty basic fact about the Bible, what the first book of the Bible is, first book of the New Testament. So at our ecclesia a few weeks ago, I said, I think we can do better. I think we should know all the books in the Bible, and we should know them all in order. So I'm not going to try to teach you all the books in the Bible in their order. I'm just going to stick to the New Testament. And in fact, there are some patterns that make memorizing the order of the New Testament easier than you might think. Well, I think I should be able to do this from memory. Next. Sorry. Yes. Do we have a... No. Okay. And then, the next books... Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, the first vowel in each of those titles, thanks, is in alphabetical order, right? And then the next, what comes next? Five T's, right? And they're also in alphabet. Sorry? Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians. I'll repeat what I said earlier. The first vowel in those 4 books, first vowel, they're in alphabetical order. All right? And then P, H, James, and then you have is that correct? Well, the patterns, you can see all the T's are together. Revelation. 3 Johns. Hebrews is here. So, 1st and 2nd Peter. I mean, if you know there's 1st and 2nd Peter, then obviously 1st Peter comes first, right? And then 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, and Jude, and Revelation. So a sequence of J's there. So if you count those up, it should come to 27. Otherwise, I've made a mistake. So there are some patterns there. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are pretty easy to remember. And I always found Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians a little bit difficult, which one comes first, until I recognize that they're in alphabetical order if you look at the first vowel, right? And then same thing with the T's, they're in alphabetical order. Was that deliberate? No, it wasn't. It just works in English. Is everybody happy? When I come next year, we'll do the Old Testament. But now I think we need to move this a little bit. We could lose it completely, yeah. Thanks. Okay, back to the podium. Every once in a while, it's nice to see if you can still do the low-tech thing. And I was visiting high schools today, and I told one of the high school counselors that at my university, we still use blackboards. We use audiovisual equipment, too, but we have blackboards as opposed to whiteboards. Okay, so I do have a hand. Double-sided handout. I only use one sheet for each. Now, what I want to do is I want to talk about the Bible with respect to ecology and the environment, but also say a little bit about other Christian perspectives on the future of the earth and how that relates to how we view the environment. I will also talk a little bit about some criticisms that are made of Christianity, and the main one with respect to the Bible and the environment, or Christianity and the environment, is that Christianity is to blame for the environmental crisis. You may not have encountered this. I encounter it very often in my field of work. So we want to look at that, think about what that claim is all about, and then we'll debunk it, okay? But before I do that, I have to tie my shoe. Sorry, I would have tripped over it, so that's done. Okay, I want to give you a quotation here. It's from a book by an evangelical who's written on the environment, and he refers to James Watt. Some of you of a certain age will remember James Watt, as mentioned here, first Reagan-era Secretary of the Interior, which makes him equivalent to the environment minister in Canada. A famous proponent of this perspective, and that is the rapture, the idea that Christ is going to take believers away to heaven and then destroy the earth, right? You're probably familiar with this. So let's look at this quotation. A famous proponent of this perspective is James Watt, the first Reagan-era Secretary of the Interior. In response to a question during a discussion on February 5th, 1981, with a committee of the House of Representatives as to why his agency was acting contrary to his expressed mandate, Watt, a devout Christian, said, "I do not know how many future generations we can count on before the Lord returns." In other words, since Jesus is coming back soon, and since when Jesus returns, everything will be destroyed, why care about the earth? Yosemite or Yellowstone, Ile Royale, which is in Lake Superior, or the Everglades, the park down the street, the local river or stream, your backyard. The popularity of books written by contemporary rapture advocating writers Hal Lindsey and Tim LaHaye attests to the allure of this eschatology. And if we were to update that comment, we would refer to the Left Behind series. Right? So this is the idea that at a certain point, Christ returns, believers are raptured. If there are airline pilots who are born-again Christians, they will be taken away, the plane will crash, et cetera, right? This is obviously a distortion of what we see in the New Testament, but it's a very, very common idea. And so what James Watt was saying is, who cares about the environment? Because Christ is going to come, rapture us away, and the earth is going to be destroyed, right? Millions of Christians believe this. Now, if that's the view you have, then taking care of the environment might not make much sense. It might seem like a fruitless endeavor. So this is one of my first points, is that there's a serious difference
between rapture theology and what we believe to be biblical theology, or what theologians would refer to as eschatology. Eschatology is just a fancy word for the teaching about the future, the teaching about the end times. And because we believe that the earth won't be destroyed, that it will be preserved, indeed renewed for the kingdom and beyond, we will have a different attitude, a radically different attitude from someone who thinks the earth is going to be destroyed. So I'll return to that a little bit later on. Shortly before my family and I moved back to Canada in 2001, my parents came over to England, and we had one last tour over there. And one of the places we visited was the Eden Project, which is built in a disused China clay pit mine in Cornwall. You can see it here as it's being prepared for opening. It looks a lot lusher now. There are trees and more grass and that sort of thing. So you have on the left three large biospheres, and this is a tropical zone, and on the right a temperate zone. And inside, lots of, this is a slightly later stage in its development. There you can see an aerial view, and there an inside view of the tropical zone. Now, when you hear the term Eden Project, immediately you recognize that the allusion is to the Garden of Eden and the Genesis account of creation. Now, I give this example because it is the case that the Genesis creation, in particular, Eden, more specifically, are often used as emblems for preserving the environment or restoring the environment. So we can see that even though in many respects we live in a post-Christian world, the legacies of biblical thought are still felt. And I'm going to give you some more examples of this. So this is one of the guidebooks that we obtained when we were at the Eden Project. So the director of this project, I don't know his background. I don't know whether he is a Christian or not. But nevertheless, he alludes to the Garden of Eden here. The original Garden of Eden is a symbol of paradise, but also of man's rejection from it. Historically, conservation policies have also assumed that the best quality environments are touched by people, and that environmental care meant keeping people out of them. The real situation is more complex than that. Now, in the environmental movement, there are different views about how humans should or should not interact with the environment. So one view is that humans should maintain a hands-off approach to the environment, that wilderness should be allowed to be wild. There should be no intervention. There are advocates of this view, one subset of them who advocate this view are referred to as deep ecologists. So deep ecology is a view that humans should not intervene much, and indeed that humans in many respects are a problem for the environment. What Tony Kendall here is advocating is the stewardship model. So the stewardship model of the environment is that there should be benign human intervention, right? So humans should be engaging with the environment, but to preserve it and to maintain it and to protect it from damage. Humans have caused lots of problems with the world, but there are also places where we have lived in harmony with nature without complete destruction, and sometimes with a beneficial effect. Many of the challenges that lie ahead can only be met by people being there, not by their walking away. Communities have already begun to make steps to be effective stewards of the world. The Eden Project is here to showcase those steps. Now, that word stewardship does come from the parables of Christ in the New Testament, is an allusion to the Bible, as is, of course, the name of this project, the Eden Project itself. Now, of course, we're not involved in politics. We're not involved in political movements insofar as they are political, like the environmental movements. So I'm not suggesting that that's the sort of thing that we should be doing. However, on a smaller scale, on a personal scale, we, I think, should, according to the biblical model, be stewards. So this is what we see in Genesis chapter 2. where Adam is told to preserve and maintain the garden. So on your handouts, it's about two-thirds of the way down on the first side. You see some bullet points there. God is the industrious planter and caring husbandman for the entire world. Genesis 1 through to Genesis 2 verse 3 serves as a model for humanity to plant and sustain the earth. So you see happening in Genesis 1 is God is planting, God's making a garden out of the world, in effect. Genesis speaks about the planting of trees in Genesis 2, but not a word about cutting them down. Of course, the Bible later on talks about cutting trees down. There's a little bit more in this handout that deals with that. But this is planting, right? So if God is being presented as a model for our behavior, then God is being presented here as a kind of gardener. And interestingly enough, we see this is the role that's given to Adam as well, right? The first human role, as it were, is to be a gardener. Given my family background, I realize that might sound a bit biased, but I think that is the case. So God as a gardener, tree planter, planting in the Garden of Eden in Genesis 2, 8 and 9 is linked to the first man, Adam. That just means human in the Hebrew, and ultimately this is Adam, the proper name, Adam, who himself is a gardener. In Genesis 2 and 15, the man, Adam, is placed in the garden to till and to keep it. So the word for till, abad, and the word keep, shamar. What do these words mean? Well, serving and preserving the garden, as you see in the next bullet point. Hebrew abad means work, serve, till, and in this context it refers to working the ground in the sense of cultivation and preparation of planting. Well, shamar means to guard, as in setting a hedge roundabout with the sense of protecting and preserving. Now, when we look at Genesis 2, what we see here is not the entire world. It's actually just a localized setting where the landscape is managed, and it's benign stewardship, right? That's the model that we're given in Genesis 2. So there's a sense in which there's a separation between the Garden of Eden. It's actually the garden in Eden. So Eden is a larger category. If you read the account carefully, there's a larger territory called Eden, and the garden is in Eden. So it's a subset of that, which is a subset of the world as a whole. So we have a model here for benign stewardship, serving and preserving the garden. Now, this point will become important when we look at the criticism of the Bible. I just want to give you a couple other examples of the use of biblical metaphors for serving and preserving the environment. I'm quite fascinated by this particular image where you see the zebra against a barcode. But notice the heading, the headline, 21st Century Ark. That is an allusion to Noah's Ark, right? So we have Genesis creation, Eden being used as symbols for the environment, Noah's Ark, the flood are often used by environmentalists, both religious and not religious, as a metaphor for preserving species, for preserving biodiversity, etc. So that's what we're seeing here. And again, I find that artwork quite remarkable. So here's another example, the frozen ark, where species, biological material from species are preserved. There's another one in Norway where they're preserving seeds to preserve biodiversity so that the seeds are kept in a kind of data bank, except it's not data, it's actual seeds. And that term ARC is used for that project. There's another project called Archive, and the symbol for it shows Noah's Ark, right? And director of this organization is David Attenborough, who is actually a very strong and strident atheist. So it's interesting that even, you know, an atheist would find the metaphor of Noah's Ark and for an atheist, of course, it would only be a metaphor, attractive one. This is one that I found in the El Al, Israeli airliner, in-flight magazine. If we can make the desert bloom, we can find a cure for cancer. And often in Israel, the term, the expression making the desert bloom, which of course comes from Isaiah 35, is used for the greening of the Negev, which is the southern part of Israel, which is very arid, a desert region. So those are some examples. Now, I said I wanted to talk about the criticism of the Bible. The most famous example of this is Lynn White Jr. This is Lynn as in a he rather than a she. The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis, published in what is still one of the leading science journals. 1967, of course, this is the 60s where you have, you know, lots of counterculture and New Age kind of thoughts and the beginnings of the environmental movement in general, whether religious or not. Now, what's he argued is summarized here. First is that monotheism in general, and Christianity in particular, is the primary, if not the sole cause, of the desolation of the earth. All right? So what he says is that religion is a problem, but particularly Christianity. It is the primary, if not the sole cause, of the desolation of the earth. Now, that's a very strong claim to make. And it's also a claim that is widely accepted by many people in the environment who are not of a Christian persuasion, that there's some core negative idea in the Bible and in the Christian tradition which has led people to rape and pillage the earth. The emphasis within the Christian tradition on dualisms of soul and body, spirit and matter, denigrates the earth and sanctions its misuse and exploitation. Now, right away, we see that this is a criticism that bounces off us, right? Because we don't hold to this radical separation between a soul and a physical body. It's a very common idea in Christianity in general, mainstream Protestantism, Catholicism, Eastern Orthodoxy, etc. Very common idea that there's a soul that escapes the body, death. Now, this idea ultimately comes from Plato, and Plato was a person who denigrated the physical material world. He believed that the purest existence was the existence of the spirit or the soul in a disembodied state. He referred to our bodies as presence. So he had a very negative view of the human body, but also the physical world. We see the beginnings of the Gnostic idea, Christian Gnosticism, which isn't really Christian, which emerges in the second and third centuries, that the God who created the material world is an evil God, right? And the good God is the God who creates the spiritual world, and that's where you want to go. So in Gnosticism, you want to escape this physical world because it's limiting, right? Our bodies age, we get sick, etc. You want to escape this plane of existence and go into a pure spiritual realm of existence. So you can see how this kind of thinking in the second, third, and fourth centuries permeated Christianity. And we get this idea that the physical world is negative, it's limiting, and that the human body is limiting. And this is where you get the cult of celibacy, right, that you see in early Christianity, et cetera, et cetera. The Bible doesn't have that view. The Bible has a very positive view of the world around us. So we just read that in Genesis chapter 1, where we see six times the expression good being used of the creation. And then the seventh time, which is emphatic in the Hebrew, seventh, seven being a number of completeness, the seventh time, it's very good. Not perfect, right? Not perfect, but good, 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 six times, and the seventh time, very good. So the biblical tradition has a very positive view of creation, and there's no separation between an evil God and a good God. It's one God who created everything. Yes, we do age. There's decline. There's decline in nature. And there's going to be renewal in the future, renewal of our bodies at the resurrection, or if we're alive at the return of Christ, a renewal of our bodies while we are alive, and then a renewal of creation. So that's the biblical view. Yes, there is decline, but the world around us is good. It's created by God. It's created by God who is good, right? So there's a very radical difference between this dualist view and the biblical view. Okay, back to the summary. And this comes from the same author I referred to earlier, Stephen Bomer Prediger. A third argument often, and by the way, Stephen Bomer Prediger, a couple years after he published this book, came to Dalhousie University, and a bunch of us went to attend his lecture, and he openly denied the immortality of the soul. And I went up to him afterwards, and I said, how do you get away with that in the evangelical community? And he says, well, you know, there's no evidence in the Bible for it. It was an interesting talk. When he began, in the next room, there was a punk rock band playing. And it really clashed with what he was saying. And he said, I really wish it was Handel's Messiah in the background, but it wasn't. Anyways, they stopped about halfway through his talk, and so we had some peace and quiet after that. A third argument, often cited by critics, derives from perceived inadequacies in Christian eschatology. Okay, so I've begun to allude to this already. This is the idea that Earth's going to be destroyed, or we're going to be lifted off the earth. We're going to go to heaven. You can see how this comes from this kind of Platonic thinking. Why do we want to be on this earth? Because it's evil. It's limiting. Why do we want to be in these bodies? We want to escape and go to this other realm of existence. And in the Christian tradition, this becomes heaven. So, in the left behind eschatology, the rapture theology, this is what you have. We're lifted off the earth. We move into a pure spiritual realm of existence, and the material world is destroyed. So why concern ourselves with serving and preserving the environment? Fourthly and finally, medieval historian Lynn White Jr., we've already referred to him in his famous and oft-reprinted 1967 essay, The Historical Roots of Our Ecologic Crisis, claims that because of its role in the rise of modern science and technology, Christianity bears a huge burden of guilt for the present situation. As some of you may know, my day job is as a historian of science, and it's a very common argument that science in the early modern period emerges out of Christianity. Now, that's a half truth. There's a lot of truth in that. Monotheism, in particular, Christianity in particular, but monotheism in general, with this idea that there is one God who creates the world. There's only one world, so there's a unity. The unity of the world is associated with the unity of God. This is a fundamental idea for the emergence of science, because in the pagan traditions, you have polytheistic pantheon, you've got various gods. They all create their own domain, and there isn't cohesion, there isn't unity. But in the monotheistic tradition, there's an expectation of unity. So when you have people like Newton beginning to work with and develop laws of nature, those laws apply everywhere, right? Newton's three laws of motion, the inverse square law, they apply everywhere. And for Newton, this made a lot of sense because he believed in one God. So, yes, there's some truth to the argument that modern science comes out of Christianity. And you'll often find a lot of Christian apologists making a big deal about this, you know, bragging about it, that science came out of Christianity. And one of the reasons why this is done is because, obviously, today science has a lot of cachet. And if you can argue that Christianity played an important role, even as midwife, to the emergence of modern science, then arguably for many people, that's going to be an impressive thing. However, we need to step back a little bit from that argument because, and again, I can assure you, just reflecting on my own background and the sorts of things that historians of science talk about, science has given us many good things, but it's given us many bad things as well. The environmental crisis, arguably, is largely the result of science and technology. Right? Yes, you could say, as an added qualification, the misuse of science and technology. But science and technology is a much more powerful force in that respect than religion, because, of course, the chemicals and other sorts of things we can produce with technology can have a very destructive effect. And I also remind you of the atomic bomb, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, right? This is not something that came from religion. It came from a political military establishment in World War II. And just think about how awful that is. So the argument that is made that science comes out of Christianity is not one that we necessarily want to support fully. And I read an interesting article by a Jewish historian of science who said, basically, if you want to make that claim, if you're a Christian, you want to make that claim, be careful what you wish for, right? Because science has been a mixed blessing. So this is a summary of Lynn White's argument, that you have the Judeo-Christian tradition, and it leads to the development of science and technology, which in turn leads to environmental degradation. History of science shows us that Christianity is not the only source for the emergence of science. There are other traditions, including the Epicurean tradition, which is actually not very religious at all. Well, the other part of Lynn White's argument, which is a very important one, and it relates to our reading from Genesis chapter 1, is that Genesis 1 teaches dominion as domination, right? So the way that Lynn White is interpreting Genesis 1, where we have this granting of dominion to humans, and we see this in verse 26 and following in Genesis 1, and God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth." So Lynn White's argument, and this is an argument that has been echoed by many other commentators, particularly those who are hostile to Christianity and to the Bible, is that this is domination, right? This is a license from God or from the Bible to rape and pillage and abuse the earth. Now, this model of domination, I argue, comes more from the Roman tradition, the Roman Empire. This idea that, you know, you subject peoples in an imperial system and that sort of thing. And Roman thinking infiltrated Christianity early on in the second and third and fourth centuries. And so the term, which ultimately comes from Latin, can be interpreted as domination. But we've just seen from looking at the Hebrew, and we alluded to this on the handout, that the account in Genesis 2 actually speaks about serving and preserving creation in the microcosm of the Garden of Eden. So this is a misreading. This is not dominion as domination. This is a benign dominion. It is the stewardship model, benign stewardship, which is what we see outlined for us in Genesis chapter 2, right? Not to crush nature, to strip nature of its resources, to overhunt and to overfish and all those sorts of things. But this is the argument that Lynn White was making, that this kind of attitude comes from that kind of thinking. Now, a much better argument can be made that this kind of attitude, the domination model rather than the dominion model, comes from something much more basic than Christianity, than religion in general, and that is our nature, right? That we're greedy, we're short-sighted, we don't think about the big picture, we just think about ourselves. And the handout refers to one aspect of this as accumulative materialism, right? Accumulative materialism is not the sole preserve of Christianity, right? All humans, in some way or other, manifest that basic greed impulse. So there's a much simpler explanation for the environmental crisis, and that is that it's the result of human nature and our lack of foresight, our greed, et cetera, et cetera. Now, Louis Moncrief argued that for a more complicated model, where you have the Judeo-Christian tradition, which gives rise to capitalism with that science and technology democratization, then that leads to urbanization, increased wealth, increased population, individual resource ownership, and then environmental degradation. So he argues for a much looser connection with the Judeo-Christian tradition in his criticism of white. Now, another author, and this is an evangelical Christian writing just over 20 years ago, critiques the Lynn White argument, arguing that this critique tends, number one, to reduce the explanation of the complex ecological crisis to a single cause, which is an oversimplification. Number two, to exaggerate the authority of Christianity in cultures. So the irony here is that those who take this argument are saying the Bible is actually really, really powerful because it's led to the environmental crisis. So there's an irony in that because most people who make that argument don't really believe that the Bible is powerful. They certainly don't believe it's the Word of God. Number three, to minimize the fact that non-Christian cultures also have been environmental despoilers. That's a very important point, right? So it's very easy to sort of turn the magnifying glass on Western culture and say, oh, you know, look how horrible the environment is in those cultures, when in fact you can find examples of environmental despoilation, et cetera, in all cultures. And in fact, arguably, the worst examples were in the former East Bloc. And countries in the former East Bloc are still suffering from the terrible environmental policies of those officially atheistic cultures, right? Buddhist cultures, Hindu cultures, every culture on Earth has a bad record on the environment. Number four, to overlook the number of dissenting opinions in Christian history. So the point here is that this dominion as domination model is not the only view within Christianity. Number five, to underestimate the potential for ecological reform in Christianity. So what Nash is arguing here is that there are other models that are actually more authentically biblical, and these would include the model I've already given you, which is the benign stewardship model. So if you look at the Bible more carefully than Lynn White Jr. did, you'll discover that that is actually the model, as we've just seen from Genesis chapter 2. So here is part of the passage I just read to you from Genesis 1, 26 and 27, and we've argued that in particular when Genesis 1 is read in conjunction with Genesis 2, what we see is a benign kind of dominion, not a license to strip the earth of its resources and species, et cetera, et cetera. The dominion is over the three realms of creation, which I'll say something about in a minute or two, because that's an important point that I want to highlight. Now, to develop the criticism of Lynn White's argument a little bit further, recent studies have shown that, number one, Western religion, including Christianity and culture, have actually not been as hostile to the environment as claimed by some. Number two, non-Western religion and culture have not been as gentle on the environment as claimed by some. We've begun to develop that. So in sum, every culture has an imperfect record. Human nature persists despite the ideals of the various world religions. You still have this fundamental flaw in human nature that we have self-centeredness, greed, and this desire for accumulating things, right? Now, it's often argued that in some ancient cultures you have a much more benign management of the environment. Often Native American cultures are presented this way. More recent work has shown that the bison were heavily overhunted by the Paleo Indians, and the megafauna extinctions of 11,000 to 10,000 years ago were human caused in part, climate change and also overhunting by paleo Indians. And one of the critics of Lynn White's argument pointed to this and said he thought that this showed that Christianity was much more ancient than many believed, because the paleo Indians were overhunting and leading to environmental problems. Ancient Mesopotamia, canal siltation, topsoil salinization due to improper irrigation techniques in the Mesopotamian region. The Anasazi Indians of the Chaco Canyon, we see by 1100 AD deforestation that led to the erosion of their fields and the demise of their crop production because they were agriculturalists. Easter Island, by the time of European contact, the islanders were clinging to existence after denuding the island of trees and other biota in the pursuit of religious ideals. And you've probably seen pictures of these statues. So they were so concerned with this religious belief. They don't understand it completely, but these are essentially what we would call, in a biblical sense, idols, that they cut down trees, used them as rollers to put these things in place. And as I said, the island was despoiled, and today it doesn't have any trees larger than sort of waist height, just bushes. So there's an example where religion did actually have a negative role. Now what we see, and this is mentioned on the handout, in the two triads of the Genesis creation, remember a number of years ago I did a study day on the creation account, and we talked about this interesting pattern where we have days 1, 2, and 3, which are days of forming, and then days 4, 5, and 6, which are days of filling, 1 and 4 match, 2 and 5 match, 3 and 6 match. What we have here, and this is emphasized in the handout, is probably the first great Western example of the notion of the relationship between habitats and inhabitants, right? So the first 3 days are the creation of habitats, and the inhabitants come in 4, 5, and 6. Yes, in the case of day 4, we're dealing with inanimate things, the heavenly bodies, but it's the same sort of idea that you have a habitat and you have inhabitants. And we also have this language of filling, and it's interesting to think about that because it's filling. It's not overfilling. It's not underfilling. It's not overfilling. So what this suggests is that already in the creation account, there is this notion that the environment has a kind of a carrying capacity, and it's not going to be overfilled or underfilled. Humans can disrupt that in various ways. You know, the bunny rabbits at UVic, they don't seem to be there anymore. Worse examples, of course, I can think of many. Just very briefly, we'll wind up in the next couple of minutes. It's interesting to point out one of the buzzwords of the environmental movement, of course, is the word green. First time the word green appears in the Bible is actually in Genesis chapter 1, where the word yerek, the Hebrew word yerek, is given. And there's a lot, obviously, behind that, if you understand the science of photosynthesis, etc., why the plants are green. But there it is. This is the created order, greenness everywhere. In Judaism, the Jewish tradition, we have some examples of very positive environmental ethics. Here's an example from the Talmud. How can a person of flesh and blood follow God? God, from the very beginning of creation, was occupied before all else with planting. So we've kind of hinted at this already. As it is written, and first of all, the eternal God planted a garden in Eden. Therefore, occupy yourself first and foremost with planting. Moses Maimonides, a medieval Jewish thinker, in order to serve God, one needs to access the enjoyment of the beauties of nature, such as the contemplation of flower-decorated meadows, majestic mountains, flowing rivers, for all these are essential to the spiritual development of even the holiest people. Now, even though the Platonic ideas had infiltrated Christianity as well as Judaism, you still see these positive ideas, which are based on the biblical positive view of the material world. If a person kills a tree before its time, it is like having murdered a soul. So that from the Jewish tradition. You can find a lot in the Christian tradition of works that argue for positive environmental ethics coming out of the biblical tradition. I've outlined a number on this handout. One has to make a distinction between authors like R.J. Berry and the Hodgsons, Michael Labate, who take a very biblical perspective, and other Christians who have a kind of neo-pagan perspective, Matthew Fox, etc., who kind of blend a kind of pagan view with Christianity. That's something that we're not going to find acceptable. But the examples I've given here take a biblical model, though, of course, in some respects, obviously, their theology is going to be quite different from ours. Green Press Initiative is an evangelical publishing initiative that focuses on sustainable paper, et cetera, et cetera. You've heard the expression, what would Jesus do? It's often misused and overused in various ways. There are Jewish and Christian environmentalists who use the expression, what would Noah do? And the idea here is that Noah preserves the species. This is the cover of the book by Stephen Poma Prediger that I was referring to earlier. I want to just wrap up by emphasizing this problem of Platonism that I've introduced earlier. Calvin B. DeWitt, in an article entitled Creation's Environmental Challenge to Evangelical Christianity, saving people out of creation has roots in the Platonic idea that physical nature is a source of ignorance and evil and is a snare to the soul, joined with the idea of human transcendence. This results in a theology which stresses salvation of the soul, dismissing as insignificant the body and the creation of which it was a part. The Bible does not make this distinction between the physical and the spiritual. It's interesting that many evangelicals, some even Anglicans, and some other sort of mainline Christians, have actually moved to the position that Christadelphians have held for over 150 years on the soul. Increasing numbers of evangelical and other Christian theologians rejecting the Platonic notion of the soul. And it's interesting, this has almost taken us by stealth, but if you look into the literature, you see that that is actually happening. So one of the problems, as I'm arguing and as others have argued, is that this Platonic idea has infiltrated Christian thought and the interpretation of the Bible. So many Christians think that the Bible actually has this kind of negative attitude towards the environment, and this idea that we need to get out of the material world and move into a pure spiritual realm of existence. That is, of course, not taught in the Bible. It's interesting to think about Revelation 11 and 18. And the nations were angry, and thy wrath has come, and the time of the dead, that they should be judged, and that thou shouldest give reward unto thy servants the prophets, and to the saints, and them that fear thy name, small and great, and shouldest destroy them which destroy the earth. What does that mean? It's interesting to think about that against the backdrop of the environmental crisis, that maybe that the destruction of the environment is a kind of sin. So, concluding points. The argument against Platonic and Gnostic forms of Christianity and Gnostic forms of Judaism, Gnostic forms of Islam, is an argument that we should be making. So we have a very strong case here because our community has always been against this kind of Platonic idea of the soul, this Platonic view of things. We can say quite forcefully that the Bible doesn't teach that, right? This is a nice kind of discussion point if you're talking to someone about the environment, for example. Another thought, can we preach against man's destruction of the environment and view the environmental crisis as a sign of the times, right, which we often do, and continue blithely to contribute it to it ourselves? So it's worth thinking about that, you know. And I've heard many, and I'm sure many of you have as well, lectures on, you know, how awful the environmental crisis is. Isn't this awful that humans have done this? And then, you know, we overconsume and pollute and that sort of thing and not realize that there's a contradiction. So it's something to think about. Global warming, of course, not everyone accepts global warming. I'm inclined to think that it is anthropogenic, at least in part. But at one level, it doesn't really matter whether we accept global warming or not, because a lot of what we do that causes environmental problems is because of accumulative materialism, right? So if we didn't live like that, we weren't so selfish, one of the byproducts would be less damage to the environment. Yes, Christ is going to come back, will restore the earth. So we could say, what's the point? But isn't that like saying, well, Christ is going to come back and do away with sin, so let's keep sinning, right? It's not necessarily a good argument. So if we believe nature is God's creation, and ultimately that's what we believe. We don't believe it's just nature, capital N, nature, but that it is the creation. This is a point I make on the handout. Can we knowingly destroy it? If we believe in eternal life on earth rather than in heaven, can we disregard the way we treat the earth? So this is what humans have been doing to the earth. This is a freeway interchange in, of course, Los Angeles. Do we want this or do we want this? Some pictures here from Victoria, around Victoria. Some of you may recognize that waterfall there. That's from the Pacific Rim National Park. I'd like to say that I took that photograph, but I didn't. And that's from Botanical Beach. And there's a beach out by Souk. So this is, of course, the beauty of creation, which we're seeing here, that we should celebrate and that we should work to serve and preserve in anticipation of that great day when Christ comes back to restore us and the creation.